Hello?
Yeah. Yes, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found. Whose crimes have gone unpunished now. Walk the streets a screaming now. They brought death to our hometown, boys. Death to our hometown, boys. Death to our hometown.
Greetings, all you 99 pretenders. Today we're going to talk once again about a political topic. Seems appropriate, given the predominance of political issues in the news today. I'm talking about the recent implosion of Republican House Speaker John Boehner's so-called Plan B bargaining last week. That ended phase one of the fiscal cliff negotiations. More on that shortly, as my latest contribution to my running commentary each week on fiscal cliff negotiations in Washington. The charade called fiscal cliff is occurring because we have a single-party system in this country, two wings of the same party. They're both in fundamental agreement regarding what they want. They want $4 trillion of deficit cuts, $3 trillion of which will be in spending, and $1 trillion in tax hikes. And most of the tax hikes we'll see will come from the middle class. You know, this 2% tax hike doesn't even get you one half of that $1 trillion over 10 years. So they're going to have to really cut middle class taxes, and they got their eyes on that. We'll be talking more about that. But it's 4-for-1, or 3-for-1, let's say. $3 in spending cuts for every dollar in tax hikes. And they're both in agreement on that, just a question of how they're going to make the mix work. Okay, we'll see how that works out in phase two of negotiations on the fiscal cliff, which will, as I say, begin very shortly. President Obama's returning to D.C. today, and we're going to see something happen in the next couple of days. If something doesn't happen in the next couple of days, watch for the stock markets to take a big dive. Over the holidays here, business interests have been really organizing from the business roundtable on the top of the business lobbying mountain all the way down, all kinds of business corporate groups preparing to put pressure on the Republicans as they are aligned, I've said before, with Obama, essentially. Why is big corporations aligned with Obama on this fiscal cliff issue? Because they know they got to get some kind of agreement on raising income taxes and cutting spending before they can come by for a second big bite of the apple, which will occur later this year in the form of big corporate tax cuts. Yeah, from 35 to at least 28%. So they know they got to get this first phase out of the way. By the way, I've been predicting this thing would come in phases, a very minor phase initially, which is in the works, then a bigger negotiation in the next couple of months, because the real deadline's only March 27th. That's when the government runs out of the money. And then there'll be a bigger cut. Bigger tax cut for corporations later in the year, and an even bigger bite at the so-called entitlements apple. You know, I don't like that term, entitlements, by the way. It's not entitlements, it's wages. It's deferred wages, wages that have been paid to workers that now they want to take back. You know, it's not enough for them to cut wages in negotiations and contracts, you know, current wages. They got to come and take back wages already paid to everybody in the form of, quote, entitlements. Anyway, none of this would be happening, you know, if we really had a multi-party system in this country. Today, my guest is Art Lippo. Art Lippo worked in the British Labour Party for a number of years, and we're going to talk with him about that experience and lessons for the U.S. should we ever get beyond our current one-party system to something resembling a two-party at minimum. But before properly introducing Art and getting on to the discussion of the British Labour Party experience and its relevance to the U.S., let me say a few things about Boehner's Plan B bargaining. Remember that thing that blew up at the end of last week? He was going to offer something here to Obama to put him in the corner, Obama in the corner over the holidays, put the pressure on him and take the pressure off of himself. It was stillborn, of course, right, setting the stage for this next phase that's coming. What is this bungled Plan B bargaining? I wrote a piece called Boehner's Bungled B Bargaining, and we should have it posted here on PRN in the next day or so. Okay, what happened? Right. Well, he had offered, Boehner had offered, to pass tax cuts for the bottom 99%. So we would only get a token minimum tax on the wealthiest 1%, which is our millionaire friends. A token, by the way, not very much. And he hoped to put pressure on Obama, but his own party shot it down. Yeah, the Tea Republicans shot it down. Well, why did they shoot it down? What happened? Well, Boehner made some very significant bargaining tactical errors, showing really what an amateur he is in this whole thing. What are some of these errors? Well, having negotiated many contracts myself in the past, there's several axioms about bargaining you never violate. Okay, what is the first one that he violated? One, he tackled the biggest issue first in negotiations. Biggest meaning the costliest and toughest to get an agreement on. What was that? Tax cuts for the rich. You know, in bargaining, what you do is approach the smaller items, try to get them put to bed, leave the bigger items for last, and horse trade. Okay, well, he didn't do that. He tried to get the big tax issue focused on and addressed initially. Big mistake. First mistake of bargaining. Second mistake is you never negotiate in one direction. He was negotiating with Obama and not paying attention to his own base. From what's leaking out from the press now, it appears he desperately pushed forward his Plan B, even though he didn't have the votes in his own base. You know, you never call for a vote guessing on the outcome. You call for a vote that you know will pass or that you want to fail. You never test your base with a vote you are uncertain of. That's axiom number two. If there's a cliff here, it's not a fiscal cliff. It's the one Boehner leaped off of in trying to push his Plan B. And what was his third major error? Well, the third major error was to tell your bargaining committee that you were going to do something even though they don't want it. Oh, well, what's his bargaining committee? To continue our union negotiating metaphor, well, his bargaining committee clearly is Budget Chairman Paul Ryan and House Ways and Means Republican Chair David Camp. He told them he was going to go ahead with Plan B anyway, even though they didn't support it. So guess what the bargaining committee did? They went back to the, quote, membership base, and they scuttled it. They scuttled him before he could even offer it. You know, another faux pas here in negotiations. Boehner clearly was looking to his upcoming election in the House on January 3rd, trying to look tough. But you never play chicken on the eve of your own election. You know, you never make it a choice of vote for what I want when you have your own vote coming up. Well, you know, all I'm saying is that Boehner really bungled this thing, passed the task on to McConnell, the Republican in the Senate. As Washington Post commentator Charlie Cook said, you know, it appears the art of negotiations has been lost. These people don't know how to negotiate. How true. They don't know what they're doing. They're flailing around. And he's finished. Boehner's finished as a negotiator. And it's going to probably be up to the Senate to craft something and to dump it on the Republicans in the House as a fait accompli here. His plan may have been a Plan B, but his bargaining skills are a generous D-. Okay. So, having said that, that's the latest commentary on fiscal cliff. We'll have more next week, by the way. And next week, for listeners, you should especially plan to tune in because I'm going to talk about my predictions. Every year at the end of the year, I make a set of economic predictions. I did so last year. And I will review my predictions from last year, last January, most of which have come true or about to come true. and I will make a new set of economic predictions for the coming year. You know, if you're an economist, you should go out on a limb and make predictions. What good is it predicting the present? That's what most professional economists do. They don't take any risks. They won't predict the future. But, of course, I do so, and I would welcome you all to come in next week. And we'll talk about the economy and the predictions. Some very interesting things happening, not only in the U.S., by the way, and not only even in Europe, but now we have another crisis brewing economically in Japan. And, of course, China and India and Brazil all slowed down. So we got some real global crises that are slowly working themselves out, and we'll see how that pans out in 2013. But first I want to introduce my friend Art Lippo. As I said earlier, Art has had a significant experience working in the British Labour Party itself, and really got a good look at that experience over the years. And we want to ask ourselves, you know, I mean, what can we learn from the British Labour Party should we ever get so lucky as to move on to some sort of real political choices here in the U.S., which is the only thing that's going to stop this kind of fiscal cliff negotiations that are going on. Okay, Art, greetings. Glad to have you here. I'm going to start with a question for you and jump in. And we're probably going to have to break in a couple minutes and take a break here, as we always do at 15 minutes after the hour. But let's start the discussion here, okay? What's the number one lesson we can learn from the British Labour Party experience here? You can maybe start with a little background on the British Labour Party if you feel like it. But that's, you know, the number one question as I see it. What can we learn from the British Labour Party experience?
Well, we can learn that forming a new party takes time, it takes effort, and it takes the backing of the trade union movement. When we talk about the labor movement in England and Britain, we mean the trade unions and the labor party. Somebody says labor movement to you, they assume you're talking about a party and the trade unions, labor movement. And the two joined together made enormous advances in the welfare of the British people. For example, the National Health Service was a product of the Labour Party, the Labour movement, with the backing of the trade unions. It is the Labour Party is, in fact, the political expression of the trade unions in Britain. So what we can learn is if we had a strong Labour Party, where the trade unions, which is the main mass organization, weak as it has become over the years, because there was no Labour Party, if we had the backing of the trade unions, we could have a National Health Service, for example.
Oh, well, that's a pretty fundamental point, I would think. And I like your reference to takes time and takes a lot of work. There are people, by the way, in the U.S. who are taking that time and doing that fundamental grassroots work in preparation for actually trying to, at some appropriate point, form a Labour Party. We've had a few of them on in previous class sessions here talking about this a little bit, but I don't want to give any further information here publicly and jump ahead of those folks, but just to let the audience know, there are things happening going on, and maybe next year as we go on with the show we can reveal more of what's actually happening. But you know, your point takes time and work. These things don't occur simply by someone calling a national conference and everybody running to the conference and everybody saying, okay, let's go back and form a party. We've seen a lot of that going on, and that kind of stuff goes nowhere. It takes a lot of real groundwork. And as you point out, another fundamental good point, Org, you know, is that it takes the backing of the unions to actually form a Labour Party. You think we're going to see the FL-CIO actually move to that kind of a decision? And if not, does that mean that nothing can be done?
I think the trade union movement is capable of forming a labor party. Whether it will or not, I don't know. Of course, I can't foresee the future. But I can tell you, unless the trade unions form a party of its own, independent of the two major parties, which are essentially an extension of Wall Street, then the trade union movement and the United States as a whole is in very serious trouble. We have a crisis. We have an economic crisis. We have a political crisis, which expresses itself in the foreign policy of the United States. We're at war. We've been in the longest war in Afghanistan for years. We're beginning to expand into Africa. So it's very serious. And the only organization, organized form, which can possibly oppose and mobilize itself to stop this trend and to institute a new social order, a new set of values, and to have the political muscle to change American society, and it desperately needs changing, is the trade union movement. Will it do it? I hope so, and I've worked for it all my life, and I learned a lot by observing the British Labour Party. It was a model. It has been a model. Now, nothing is an absolute model. Nobody should say, oh, there's a mechanical model there, and that do exactly what they did. Britain is different than the United States, as you all know. But nevertheless, there are some important lessons in the history and the formation of the Labour Party. Labour Party wasn't just created out of thin air by a bunch of people saying, oh, we're the Labour Party. It emerged out of decades of work, I like the word emerge. We're going to see a Labour Party, if it does happen, it will emerge out of local activity, out of national activity. But I would keep that word emerge in mind. And I don't use the term, some people will say, oh, that's a third party. I use the term a new party. And actually, a second party. We don't have a opposition party. And I think that's the key to understanding American politics, the lack of an opposition political party. I call it the black hole, the astronomical phenomenon. There's something missing in American politics. And when I taught my classes in Britain about American history, American politics, I said, you've got to understand that there's something missing. You can't see it, but it has an enormous force, enormous attractive force, and destructive force. We don't have an opposition political party, and only the trade unions can mount a effort that would lead to the formation of a second and ultimately a majority party. I'm interested not in third parties, but in majority parties. And the Labour Party in Britain became the majority party after World War II. Churchill was riding high. And he thought, oh, I'm going to win the election in 1945. And he didn't. The British people repudiated Churchill after the war, after he led, as Prime Minister, led the Britain in World War II. They said, enough is enough. Enough Toryism. Enough conservatism. We want a welfare state. We want a socialist country. And they repudiated Churchill in 1945, and the Labour Party, under the leadership of Clement Attlee, came to power and instituted the major reforms that really hang on even now under a conservative party. Of course, there have been many ups and downs and backs and forwards, and that's an interesting story all by itself, why the Labour Party is where it is today. So that's what happened. But I would focus on a term, emerge. A movement emerges. It isn't just, you don't wave a wand and then have a meeting and there's a Labour Party. I would use the term emerge, and it emerges, I think, especially in the United States, a big country geographically in terms of population, from local activity. You know the saying, how does it go? Think globally, act locally. And I think that's not a bad slogan at all, especially for the United States.
Well, some very good points. I want the listeners to hang on this question of emerge and local origins as the way these kind of things happened. We went a little bit past our break time, but let's take a break right now, and we'll come back and pick up our discussion. And if the engineer gets my signal there, let's break, listen to some Bruce Springsteen, and we'll come back and continue this discussion on local origins of such an alternative party. Jack Rasmus, your host for Alternative Visions, and we're talking with my guest Art Lippo, a longtime experienced activist and Labour Party in Britain. We're talking about the origins of the Labour Party in Britain and lessons of that experience for today. And Art made a very important point, I thought, and that was the surprise that occurred in 1945. When everyone thought that Winston Churchill and the Conservatives, the Republicans, were firmly in control at the end of the war of the political situation there, got a very rude surprise when everybody threw them out and voted Labour Party in. Okay, you know, we should think in those terms. Wasn't there a bit of a surprise this last November? Yes. Minorities and youth workers and unions in certain states kind of pulled a big upset. Of course, they pulled it on behalf of Obama, one wing, the liberal wing of the party, of the capitalists today, the corporations party today. But nonetheless, it was a bit of a surprise. These changes can come out of nowhere with people not really expecting or anticipating them happening. And, you know, we may be surprised if these people don't solve these problems that are in front of us over the next year or two of something even more progressive coming out from left field and initiating some changes. Okay, so, Art, what's different? What's different about the U.S.? You made a good point that it's not the same. Every country has its own different way of developing. What do you see as the prospects in the U.S. itself?
Well, I think the prospects are good. Movements emerge by surprise. I was a civil rights activist. Nobody predicted the civil rights movement. They emerge, as it were, out of a whole confluence of forces. So I think the prospects for a Labour Party, a new party, given the crisis, the economic crisis, the political crisis in this country, are good. But it means a break with the ideas and ideology of the Democratic Party. It means a break with the Democratic Party, which is composed at very best of two wings, one slightly more conservative, one more conservative, and one more liberal. The liberal wing can be broken off, but the most important thing is for there to be an independent expression of labor's needs in the form of a new set of ideas and party. For example, we're facing a terrible attack on the trade union movement, right-to-work laws being passed, for example, in Michigan, the heartland of the birth of American labor. But the law which permits right-to-work laws, the Taft-Hartley law, has been on the books for 50 years. And people in the trade unions have been saying, oh, we have to support the Democratic Party because that's the only way we can repeal Taft-Hartley, the right-to-work section of Taft-Hartley. I think it's Section 14B. Well, it hasn't happened. There have been Democratic majorities over and over again, and it's a demonstration that the majority of Democrats are conservative and anti-labor. Can't do it. It hasn't happened all these years. I don't say the whole thing matters, a legal matter. Obviously, you need a movement. You have to go out to appeal to people. And this is the other thing, and that's social idealism. Trade union movement is too much like a, what can I say, like a business. Well, in fact, we have a word for it, business unionism. It can only succeed when it appeals to the ideals of the American people. The greatest example, I think, of an idealistic leader of the trade union movement was Walter Reuther, who had been a socialist, and he tied social idealism to trade union movement. And that's what we have to have. People will be attracted when they think of unions not as businesses, not as a bunch of selfish people grabbing this or grabbing that, but as a ideal movement for the transformation of American society. Idealism is a very powerful force. The way the civil rights movement fed on idealism, racial and economic and social justice. And when the trade unions are identified with that, rather than being just another wing of a business party, then they will have exert a tremendous force, especially among young people who are the backbone of the Occupy movement and are looking for an alternative to the country and the parties being run by the 1%. When it does that, then one of the things that will happen is the trade unions themselves will begin to grow. They will grow because people will say, let's have a union. Let's do something good. Let's change the world. And I think that's the important thing. I think there's a good chance of that. The need for it is obvious. I don't think I should have to argue on this program the need for such a movement. But ideas and ideals are very important. We have to understand what is going on in this country, the injustices that people have, foreclosures, unemployment, poverty, and a trade union movement which takes the leadership, not on the basis of, oh, you join a union, but on the basis we will have a program for correcting these things, for change in society, for equality, for social justice. And that will have a tremendous psychological and intellectual impact on the population. I have to tell you, in 1945, I have a very clear memory of my father, who had been a socialist as a youth, coming to me and said, oh, we've had a tremendous victory in Britain. Well, that's Britain, I said. No, it means a victory for socialism. It means a victory for idealism. It's what we should have always had in this country. People were tremendously excited, and they set about to form a labor party modeled on a British labor party in this country. But that example of a welfare state, of a socialistic society, had a tremendous impact, and the trade unions grew at that point. CIO, and even the AFL, which was a more conservative trade, craft-based organization, grew and became a major, it had been a major force as a result of the 1930s upheaval, but it began to grow. And then, that's history, and we need to know that history. And if I have anything to say today, it would be learn the history of the trade union movement. Learn the history of the what happened and also what didn't happen in 1945, 1946, 1947, 48, Those are crucial years. And to learn that history, what impeded and the emergence of a Labour Party and of a really idealistic movement. One of the things that impeded it was a kind of crude, vulgar anti-communism. The trade union movement became part of the anti-communist crusade. Communism is not socialism, it is not progressive, it is not democratic, but the trade union movement turned itself into a right-wing organization to mirror and mouth the slogans of the Cold War and become part of the apparatus of the Cold War. So I think what's different now is there's a possibility of a global movement. There's a need for a global movement of social idealism and to go beyond the stale and regressive ideas of the Cold War, where everything was anti-communism. But now we have a chance for a pro-social progress movement. Change the world, but change it in a progressive direction. End poverty. There's a determined effort to twist people's minds around the idea of a war on terror. There are terrorists all over the place, and people are being hunted out in Africa, in all over the world. There's a terrorist war, but we don't talk about social justice, economic justice, and that the disorder of the world, the majority, overwhelming majority of the world's people, and frankly, in the United States too, live in poverty. They want social and economic justice, and the answer to the war on terror is social and economic justice, a global movement for social and economic justice. So,
well, let's,
that's what
if I can interrupt you,
back in 1948.
Art, let's, we need to take another break here briefly, but when we come back, let's talk about labor and a minority, I mean a majority party. You know, labor is only 12% of the labor force. And the need for allies. Who would be the allies in a Labor Party in the U.S. is the next question. But first, let's take a break, and we'll come back to our discussion after that short break. Alternative Visions, my guest, Art Lippo, the topic, an alternative real second party, whether you call it a labor party or whatever, a majority party, and the potential for some real change, without which we will just witness more and more fiscal cliff-like negotiations. As I've said before, you know, what's going on this fiscal cliff? That's just austerity American style. That's all. The European Europe, it's been going on now for several years, beating down the working and middle classes in Europe in order to pay for the speculation and gains for the big bankers and investors. That's what austerity is all about, making the rest of the folks pay for the problems created by the very rich in getting even richer. And we're seeing that emerge. By the way, you know, no one is talking when they say fiscal cliff or the alternative, no one is recognizing that the alternatives that they're proposing to the fiscal cliff today will impact the economy even more negatively than the fiscal cliff itself. Yes, the alternatives are going to slow the economy and make things worse. It's almost as if saying, well, we're probably better off if we just went over the fiscal cliff, which, of course, as I've written elsewhere, is grossly exaggerated, the economic impact of the fiscal cliff should nothing be done. Art talked about poverty rate. Yes, we've gone from about 10% in the 90s to 15.1% poverty rate again in the United States, approaching where it was in previous decades. We're going backwards in terms of poverty. We've got 12 million homeowners who have been foreclosed in recent years, 11 million still underwater, 30 states still in deficit. We've got 22 million people still unemployed. We've got a drop in real income for the median family of over 10% in the last decade, still falling. No wonder they can't get the economy going. People don't have any money spent except credit cards and taking money out of their savings or taking on more debt. Yes, the conditions are there. And now, as we've spoken in previous radio shows, they're forming this global free trade zone in the Pacific. And most recently, the U.S. has started negotiations with the Eurozone for another free trade zone over on the other side. We know free trade means even fewer jobs and even lower wages and income. But as Art said, I think very importantly, you need an idealist vision of an alternative. It's not just conditions itself, deteriorating conditions. Gosh, that's been going on all over a decade. Well, 30 years, actually. Conditions don't cause change in and of itself, but a conscious effort to present an alternative to the present and an organizational effort to try to bring that alternative vision to reality. Art, you said the important thing about majority party. I can't agree with you more. It's got to be from the bottom up, and it's got to be a majority. Labor's only 12% organized labor. Who would be the partners that labor would, in this country, join with to try to create a new organizational effort and a new vision?
Well, I think you have to become clear about the nature of class in this country. There has been a determined effort to distort our understanding of class. This language that Obama and everybody else uses about the middle class is a distortion of reality. The middle class used to mean the self-employed professionals, the doctors, the lawyers, the small farmers. That was the middle class in the 19th century and perhaps the earlier part of the 20th century. That middle class no longer exists. The people are working class or employed class. When back in 1960, 70, we could hardly imagine that there would be 3 million teachers who were members of a trade union, a very powerful union. 3 million of them, the National Education Association, American Federation of Teachers. Hardly imagine it. They considered themselves professionals, middle class. That was an ideology. They were captured by that, but then reality caught up with them. So what we have in this country is an enormous working class. I want to say that. It's very clear to get that straight. These are people who work for a living. The corporations and government dominates the employment scene. You work for the government, or you work for the giant corporations, you're an employee. And in other countries, people who are employees join unions. And the way in which the new party, new labor party, will be built will be by people who are suddenly wake up, and does happen suddenly, by the way, and say to themselves, I'm employed, I need somebody to represent me. Who's going to represent me with the government? We have public employee unions. Who's going to represent me with the school boards? We have the teachers union, a great example of how things got transformed almost overnight. 3 million members who considered themselves yesterday, literally yesterday, considered themselves professionals. They're not workers. They suddenly joined this union, which is less powerful than it would be if it was independent of the Democratic Party. But so we have a class structure that has changed. I've written an article called How the Working Class Became the Middle Class. It didn't really. That's a language trick. People got to be persuaded they're not really just working people. They're working people, and they have something in common with other working people. The 1% dominates everything. They provide employment. Now it's a global 1%. A global 1%. Now, are the employers, the governments, the state,
and the global corporations. So anybody who works in an office or who works at Starbucks or who works as a teacher or who works as a doctor is an employee. Doctors join trade unions today. They didn't think about that 25, 35 years ago. And so the use of the term, the way the term middle class is used, is meant to obfuscate, to make unclear the real class relationships in this country. The overwhelming majority of the people in this country are working class, employed class. Use whatever term you like, employed class, working class. They're not middle class in the sense of being self-employed. They're not a farmer. They're not a car dealer owner, a car dealership. They're not a. They're not all the other things that traditionally we thought of as middle class, because they don't exist any longer. That class doesn't exist. The small farmers are completely wiped out. 6,000 towns have disappeared in the United States, which was the heartland of the American farming class, both the farmers. 6,000 towns have disappeared in the last 20 years. That's where Middletown was. That's where the so-called middle class was. Don't exist any longer. So we start with a recognition that people need to have a representative.
Well, who would be labor's allies?
Right, represent themselves with their employers, the government, that's public employees, or the big corporations.
Well,
so that's
Art,
where the majority will come from. And
Art.
Also, again, what will tie them together is idealism and the idea that it's not just me for myself, but it's us for all of us. Solidarity.
Art.
That's been the slogan of the labor movement in its progressive period. Progressive period meant everybody for everybody else. Solidarity forever.
Art.
And when that
Art.
Happens, people like the teachers. I saw it happen in front of my eyes. The teachers, within a period of a decade, became unionized. They're the most powerful union in the country. They don't use it properly because they're tied to the Democratic Party. And the truth is, I'm sorry to say, the Democratic Party owns the teachers' union, runs them. And then they have big billionaires like Microsoft billionaire and other people who, in effect, nominate and set the policies of the administration of the Democratic Party because they don't want that big force of organized teachers. Anyway, that's a simple answer to a complicated question. But there's no reason why ordinary people who are working people should not join a union. Walmart is the latest example. The clerks in Walmart are the latest example of people who are unionizable. Walmart, the post office. Post office is being wiped out, partly in order to remove the postal workers' union. Not a conspiracy, but that has happened. And so forth and so forth. So that's where the majority is going to come from. What is being called, and to make things unclear, being called the middle class. It's a working class, the employed class. If you don't like the term working class, it's the employed class. And that's what we can build a new labor party on. Without it, people will continue to be confused and become unemployed and unemployable. They will live lives which will be dictated by their employers, not by a democratic organization from below, which is what a union is, a democratic organization organized from below.
Well, let's take our last break here. Alternative Visions. We're talking once again about a new political formation in the U.S. How likely is it? Will the unions be at the lead of it? Who will be the allies? Art, in the 2 minutes, I'd like to remain talking with you. Could you just try to identify who might be the allies of a union movement in forming a new political party here. I mean, is it the Occupy? Is it youth? Is it minorities, Latinos, Asians, African Americans? Who should be the focus of the creation of a new majority movement that would create a new party? 2 minutes, and then we got to leave. Art, are you there? No, I guess we lost Art. We didn't have a very good connection, and I apologize to our friends here listening that Art couldn't hear very clearly what was going on, and I guess he has tried to reconnect and hasn't been able to. Anyway, so let me finish a few topics here before we leave. Next week's show, I'm sure we're going to have a lot more of interest to talk about on the fiscal cliff. A lot is going to happen over this weekend as we approach the January 1st so-called deadline here early next week. So we'll have a lot to say on the fiscal cliff. But the topic next week that I really want to get into is predictions for my last year's predictions, economic predictions, and my coming year's predictions. What were some of the predictions last year that were made in December 2011? How have they played out over the coming year? Well, here's just a few of what I had talked about. I had predicted there would be a third version of quantitative easing, QE3, by the Federal Reserve. And, of course, we saw that here in last September, October. We did get a QE, and the whole global central banks around the world are all moving towards even more money expansion as they tighten up on the fiscal side. I also predicted that real deficit reduction will begin with great earnest immediately following the November 2012 elections, and of course that's what it is. That's what we're calling the fiscal cliff. So that one has come true. I predicted job growth will continue to stagnate and remain in the greater than 20 million range throughout 2012, and we would see some false starts in job recovery, determined mostly by seasonal and other statistical factors, and I think that's pretty much been the case, hasn't it? We're not really reducing joblessness much in this country. We're just churning out high-paying jobs and replacing them with part-time temporary jobs. I had predicted that home prices will continue to fall and foreclosures rise and negative equity grow. Well, foreclosures have continued to rise, but prices, of course, have continued now to recover a little bit, so a little bit off on that one. But I did also predict U.S. exports and U.S. manufacturing would slow, which is really happening, and that the Eurozone sovereign debt crisis will stabilize and then worsen again. All right, and in Europe, Germany and France would experience a recession in 2012. And the UK would have a double dip, all of which has come true. China's economic growth rate will slow, which has happened, and global trade will slow and begin to contract in 2012. Well, it certainly slowed, although it hasn't contracted. Anyway, we're going to come back and look at those predictions in more depth next week. And you can read my forecasts on my website, which is Kyklos Productions, KYKLOSProductions.com. Just Google me, Jack Rasmus, and you'll see my website and all my published articles and presentations and TV and radio interviews there, focusing a lot in recent weeks on the fiscal cliff, and will continue to do so. Or just blog me at JackRasmus.com. My shorter weekly articles are up on that particular site, JackRasmus.com. Or if you want to pick up on my daily one-liners as to what's happening, you can reach me on Twitter at #DR for Dr. Dr. Jack Rasmus. Okay, so next week we're turning back to big economic issues, and we'll talk to you then. This is Alternative Visions, Jack Rasmus, your host.